Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Dwight Gooden with Helping Hands Community Outreach. Emily McCord has Politics Ohio and a report on the growing numbers of influenza this season. Up first, joining me in studio, filmmaker Julia Reichard. This week, WISO premiered Reinvention Stories, a project that Julia is going to tell us a little bit about today.
Yes, I love talking about that project.
So let's talk about the inception, the idea, and how this began.
Reinvention Stories, yeah, it was kind of a brainchild of Nina Ellis, Steve Bognar, and I back well over a year ago. So we decided to do we got actually funding to do a project that had to be a local focus, had to be about Dayton. And we put our heads together and thought, you know, the fact is Dayton was very hard hit not long ago, hard hit economically, which then had all these repercussions. You know, the housing crisis, population loss. Population went precipitously down for a couple years there, a few years. People moved away, no jobs. It was a scary time. So we thought, let's go back into Dayton for the whole summer, for like months, and just sort of say, where are we now? I mean, you may remember that Forbes magazine called Dayton one of the fastest dying cities in America just a few years ago. So, well, the question was, are we dying? Or are we, as a city of inventors, reinventing ourselves? Is that what's going on? And honestly, at the beginning of the process in March and April of last year, we really didn't know. But we went out, as you know, and you were one of them, with just a team of people, audio people who are very experienced, newcomers, community voices people, young filmmakers from Wright State. We went out and we just went all over Dayton to collect stories, to see how people are reinventing and to see how the city is reinventing.
And this was a unique process because we were really essentially a roving gang of reporters.
You could say we were like a gang with our backpack on our back with our little hidden cameras. They weren't hidden. Hidden in the backpack. And tape recorders. Yeah, there were probably close to 20 of us over the summer who went out. And it was really a lot of fun. Of course, the heat wave didn't help, but it was a lot of fun, and we learned just a ton, and we met great people. And we probably gathered 60 or 70 stories. I think WISO, the stories on WISO, which are going to start coming out every week now, I think there's going to be at least 15 of them, maybe more. We're still trying to figure that out. And Sarah Buckingham has come on to cut a lot of those, and she's awesome at that. So we were like a roving band, and we covered events, everything from like Free Shakespeare in the Park, Urban Nights, the Gay Men's Chorus, the African-American Festival, the Latino Festival, you know, you name it. We covered events like bike rallies, blessing of the bikes, big and small events that took place in Dayton all summer, all spring, summer, and fall. And then interviews with people who we met walking their dog on their porch, not set up the usual way reporters set up interviews. You know, we didn't call sources and ask for the best expert. We just wanted to see who was out and about and meet our neighbors. So that's what we did.
And I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about what you learned about the city that we live in.
You know, that is such a great question, Jerry. And that's a question that we all will be answering. Not, I don't mean just our team. I mean our whole city. Is, I think, honestly, one thing I found is I think the city is in the process of answering that question. I would say for me, and we're still editing, but I would say we are not dying. I would say we are living. I would say we are reinventing. I would say it's uneven. I would say there's great stuff going on downtown and in some of the neighborhoods. I would also observe that there still are people who are really struggling financially, who used to make good wages and have good benefits, and now, even 4 years after the crash, are making $10 an hour, and they have several kids. I know people who have lost their homes. I know people who have been homeless, who have lived in abandoned buildings. All that is still true, but there are so many signs of life, activity, fun, art, music going on. New businesses opening that are flourishing. So it's very uneven, but I think my feeling is, mark my words, in a couple years, I have a feeling this summer is going to go down as the summer Dayton turned around. That's what I think right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the people that we came across, because my experience with visiting several times Dayton neighborhoods was that some people, though they knew a lot about their city, didn't really feel that they could be the spokesperson or felt like they could talk well about their city. But most people were very enthusiastic about the project.
Yeah, I think people like the opportunity to evaluate, to think about, like, well, my city, yes. How is my neighborhood is a lot easier than how is my city? How is my block doing? How is my neighborhood doing? But also people like the chance to look at their own lives and think, am I reinventing myself in some way? And some people, it's very obvious. They lost their job. They lost their home. They went back to school. They chose a new career path. But many people were very willing to sit right down on their porch. I mean, it's quite a friendly town. Almost nobody refused to take our leaflet, just said, get out of my face. That just virtually never happened. Imagine if we were in New York City or Los Angeles, you know. It's a friendly town. People were open. People loved WISO. Those people knew of it. We had a lot of fun. What can I say? We had a lot of fun. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the scope of the project. We hit five communities.
Four neighborhoods were targeted and downtown. So the four neighborhoods that were targeted were Belmont, Twin Towers, South Park, and Residence Park. So we kind of had both east and west, kind of the sides of the town, that is Belmont and Residence Park. And then we had two more so closer to the city, like South Park is a great example. We also have stories from St. Anne's Hill. We actually have one from Fairborn. We have a number of downtown stories, like Olive, you know, is one of our stories. Some of the pop-up shops are some of our stories. And that's an interesting sign of life, the pop-up shops. But those were the main neighborhoods. And so you'll see those of you who live in Belmont and South Park and Twin Towers and Residence Park will see your neighborhoods and will see people from your neighborhoods, stories from your neighborhoods.
And so this week, WISO premiered its first reinvention story. It's about the 5th Street Brew Pub, Ohio's first brew pub co-op, and only the second in the nation slated to open this year. Brian Young is the president of the board, and Maureen Berry is the co-op's membership director. The couple wanted to fix up a neighborhood eyesore. The former American Saloon on East 5th Street in Dayton, St. Anne's Hill Historic District.
It wasn't attractive at all to look at. And it's on our main thoroughfare through our neighborhood. It kind of gives a bad impression of the rest of the neighborhood. So Brian got the idea when we moved into the neighborhood in 2007. He, I think from the day we moved in, really wanted to improve it and see it become something nice for our neighborhood.
I guess it was maybe my idea. And then I got Joe Durkers, who was a commercial realtor in Dayton here. He and I were wanting to get this eyesore off the, eyesore list. So we just decided to get a bunch of neighbors together, put $1,100 in each to buy it and transform it.
Yeah, we didn't have the money to do it ourselves, nor the time, because we both work full time. And so we all invested, a little bit. And that is the money that we spent to fix up the exterior of the building.
That was first, and the brew pub idea came much later. A brew pub is a place where you brew your own beer and you serve food. So there's breweries, there's some opening up in Dayton as well, but they just brew the beer and they'll distribute. We don't plan on distributing, we just plan on brewing for our own place here, and then we'll also have be a restaurant. When we took control of it, we weren't thinking brew pub. We were thinking just, let's fix it up to a point where it can be attractive to someone to have a restaurant in here, or basically anything that we knew would be sustainable. And then after a couple of years where we didn't get a buyer for it, a friend of mine called me from Texas one day and said, hey, I think I got a good business model for your bar that you have empty. I'm like, really? And he said, yeah. He said, okay, what is it? And he was like, it was a co-op.
At first you were like, God, that would be a lot of work. But the more we learned about it, the more we thought it's the perfect fit, because this started as a community project and this was our way to finish it that way, for it always to be a community project.
We had a goal of 300 people. With 300 people, we know it's a good idea. We had 300 people in, I think, 2 weeks or less.
I honestly think a lot of people joined just to help this project come to life. We definitely have a big group of home brewers and, you know, craft beer lovers for sure. But I think we also have quite a few people who are who just want to see us succeed and fix this building up and make it something nice for the neighborhood.
You don't see a whole lot of co-ops going under because there's so much support from so many different people in the membership. No one gets rich, mind you. I mean, there's no big, you know, the fat cat at the top making money. It's bigger than any of us. It's its own entity, and it's something that is good for all. It's a place to meet, have a beer, and bring people to your place. You know, anyone who is a member can say it just as much as Maureen or I could. You know, come to our place, our bar, because everybody owns the same amount. I think that's what's cool. I think that's what people are loving, that idea, because there's no other place you can do that around here. I mean, I know banks have it, but, you know, like credit unions are co-ops, but...
You don't want to go hang out there.
Right. It's nowhere where you want to go hang out. And same thing with sort of some co-op grocery stores. But this is special because it's a brew, but you're brewing your own beer. And people who like beer, you know, they can run for the board someday and have input on that. They can all vote for the board if they don't want to run for it. That's a powerful model. It really is. And these are the kind of things, these independent little operations are what's going to grow Dayton. Now, I don't think any big corporate, you know, savior is going to come in and save Dayton.
Yes, Delphi has, you know, all these bad things have happened and GM is closed and whatnot, but I think there's a lot of creativity and a lot of opportunity here.
That was Brian Young and Maureen Berry of the 5th Street Brew Pub. For more information, visit 5thstreet.coop. Today's reinvention story was produced by Eric Risher, Leslie Fogel, and Sarah Buckingham.
Well, so I love the Brew Pub story because it's a community story. It's a story about people in a community who came together to save a blighted building and create something new that would be for the good of the whole community. So it's a really neat reinvention story. It's a neat reinvention story of a building, right, done by many, many people. So next week, we have a different kind of reinvention story. It's the reinvention story of one guy named Kevin. He was a guy, a young guy working in the corporate world, wearing a suit, worked for a bank, you know, that kind of thing. And then he really felt his inner love was to be an artist. And he was a good artist, but he didn't ever feel he could make money at it. So Kevin is now a tattoo artist. And that's his reinvention. He works with Truth and Triumph Tattoos, which is in Belmont, one of our four neighborhoods. So we go from St. Ann's Hill to Belmont this week. And we're going to meet Kevin at Truth and Triumph and hear his story of how he managed to reinvent himself.
To see a short film on the 5th Street Brew Pub Co-op, visit WYSO.org. There'll be more to follow. And Julia, the multimedia component to this project is an important one.
Yes, actually. And that's a hard one to get your head wrapped around, I'll tell you. What we've been working on for months now is a big standalone website that, of course, will be linked to the WISO website, a big website that is a nonfiction storytelling interactive website where you will see more lengthy movies. You will see connections to the dogs of Dayton, the tattoos of Dayton, the history of Dayton, photographs of Dayton's past. You'll be able to interact. There will be questions posed to you that you will answer. It's very, very exciting. But I would just say, just hang on to your hats until the end of January when this thing will go live, and we will certainly tell you about it.
Reinvention Stories are brought to you by WYSO and Local Lore, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, Incorporated, with financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Julia Reichert, thanks so much for stopping by.
You're welcome, Jerry. Happy to be here.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Flu cases are up this season, and reports suggest the number of people being hospitalized for flu is up more than 10 times than previous years. Public health officials are still investigating the possible flu-related death of a 22-year-old Fairborn woman, and Ohio health authorities say one Ohio child has died from flu complications. WYSO's Emily McCord spoke with Bill Warden from the Public Health Department for Dayton and Montgomery County, who says 700 people have been affected in Montgomery County alone since October when the flu season began.
We're both having an early flu season, and it's really coming on pretty strong. We may have peaked, or we may be very close to the peak of our flu season here in Montgomery County, But we don't know that for sure because while in the past week our numbers of reported cases coming in for flu and flu-like illnesses from the hospitals have taken a little drop, the one thing we don't know is that now that the kids have all gone back to school, those numbers may start to climb again.
Do we get a sense of how this might compare to last year?
Oh, last year was a very, very mild flu season. And this year, it's much more serious. We're very comparable to across the country right now. The thing that's a little bit different is that while we may have peaked, it appears that some of the areas, like some of the hospitals in Pennsylvania and Boston, they're really having a very rough time right now.
Why are we not having the same problem that Boston and Philadelphia are having?
Well, we are having a lot of hospitalizations, and the numbers are up quite a bit from what they were in previous years. It's just that right now we may have gotten close to what our peak is. In other words, when you start earlier in the flu season to get a lot of flu cases, you tend to also peak earlier. Now, what we do know for certain is that the flu season usually goes to February or March. So we have every reason to expect that we're going to continue to see a lot of flu for the remaining part of this season. And that's why everybody should get a flu shot.
So tell me about the flu shot. Why is it a good idea for people to get that?
Well, the flu shot actually is formulated a year ahead of time. And what happens here is that the feds have to basically guess what flu strains are going to be the most of a problem in the coming year. And last year they guessed very well because most of the strains that are going across the country are the same strains that are in the flu vaccine. So that means that if people get the flu vaccine, they've got a very good chance of matching up with the flu that's going around.
Is there still enough time that that'll make a difference to get one?
Yes. It takes about 2 weeks from the time that you get your flu shot until you get your full immunity. So the sooner you get it, the better. And, you know, some people are probably thinking, well, it doesn't always work. And that's true. It doesn't always work. But it's still, at this point, the best protection anybody can get. Usually coupled with the flu shot, you need to consider whatever you can to build your own personal immunity to its highest level. And that usually entails something like making sure you eat well, make sure you get plenty of rest, make sure you exercise. All the basics of good health help to keep your immunity as strong as possible.
And is there any concern about the supply of flu shots?
In Montgomery County, we have plenty of vaccine. There are some places across the country, I understand, that are having difficulty getting enough vaccine. But.
And if people want to know where they can get it, what do they do?
Well, in most areas, at least around this region, most people can get it at many of the big box retail stores, the Walmarts, the Walgreens, those types of places. And we have plenty of vaccine here at Public Health Dayton, Montgomery County, and we're located here at the Reibold Building. The cost of the flu vaccines in most places is right around $20, somewhere in that ballpark. And the plus of getting it from the public health department is that if you can't afford the shot, we'll still give it to you. In other words, all flu shots are based on ability to pay.
Thank you. This is all really helpful information.
WISO's Emily McCord speaking with Bill Warden from the Public Health Department for Dayton and Montgomery County. Last week, a settlement was reached between the federal government and 10 mortgage servicers that will result in millions of dollars being paid out to homeowners who underwent faulty foreclosures. That includes homeowners here in the Miami Valley. People who filed the paperwork to have their foreclosures assessed could receive anywhere from several hundred dollars up to $125,000 if there were, in fact, problems with their foreclosures. Dwight Gooden is the operations manager for the Restoring Stability Program with Helping Hands Community Outreach. I spoke with him about Helping Hands services and their role in helping those homeowners affected by the faulty foreclosures.
That process was called an independent review, whereby there was an independent agency who researched and is currently researching those home loan modifications on homes that were initiated between 2008 and 2010. The purpose of the review was to determine procedures or situations where a homeowner may have been taken advantage of or where applications were not processed properly for a modification, which resulted in either eviction of the home, loss of the home, or some financial loss to the homeowner.
Can you give me an idea of some of the numbers of people that you saw with regard to this specific issue and then numbers of people who you did find to have undergone faulty foreclosures?
Over the past couple of years, we have somewhere around 578 mailings that were sent out about this particular independent review program. We have also serviced somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3,000 clients under the various programs, Making Home Affordable being the federal guideline programs to assist them with HAMP, a home affordable modification program. the Home Affordable Financial Alternative, and a couple other programs that fall under purview of HUD.
And you said you sent out at least 578 mailings, and what kind of a response did you pull in from that?
We got some response. We had homeowners who did apply with that. They came in to request assistance in getting the forms filled out and sent in for the independent review. Most of those files submitted were done, and I think the program terminated on about 31 December. There was some talk about an extension. I've not yet seen evidence of an extension, but there was some talk late in the program that they may consider extending it for some time.
Okay, so it's not that you found 578 faulty foreclosures. Do you have those numbers?
No, I don't right now. I don't have the actual result of the surveys. In some cases, taking some time. I got really involved in the program in November, December. We had a rush at the end of the program, and I think it initially started sometime in the early spring. That was assigned to an independent review agency in supposedly June and July. But my personal involvement with this program came as it was coming to an end when some of the homeowners were panicking and coming in trying to get some assistance and getting the forms filled out and submitted.
And so they're actually still determining some of the mortgages that qualify for this program, correct?
Right. A lot of the mortgages were done, I think, between 2008 to 2010. Those were qualifying mortgages, or in some cases, the results of actions that were generated by the banks during that period of time. And there's supposed to be some financial settlement ranging from, I think, $1,000 up to somewhere in excess of $125,000, depending upon whether the homeowner were actually evicted or just suffered financial loss. The process is still ongoing. I don't know exactly what the time window is for the process, but I know based on the amount of files they've gotten and the size of their staff, it's going to take, I would say, anywhere from 4 to 6 months to process a single application.
Okay. So, as you mentioned, the larger payouts could come from someone who underwent a faulty foreclosure, lost their home. Could they be reimbursed for the value of their home?
In some cases, I don't know exactly how they come up. The guidance that I saw, the literature that I did read on that, indicated they would be awarded up to that amount of money. Now, in some cases, they were given transition payments. They may have signed for one of the programs that would give you payments to move. And there was some effort by the bank to cushion the blow and hardships of the clients back at the time the incident happened. But the independent review would go back and take a look at the documentation. They would look at the process and procedure, and they would look at the guidance that was given by the servicer to the homeowner to circumvent their liabilities in some cases, and in a lot of cases, by the homeowners not knowing exactly who to go to. Housing counselors not aware of all the programs that were out there. We just experienced a learning curve that is just now trying to resolve some of the problems that were encountered 2 and 3 years ago.
And are you aware of any timeline? The national distribution or the deal worked out was, I think, $8.5 billion around the nation. Do you have any timeline for the completion of this? Essentially a reimbursement or those funds coming back to homeowners?
No, I don't, because what I've seen in my involvement with that is in a lot of cases there was some documentation sent to the homeowner from the bank, and they were advised to contact HUD or a HUD-approved housing counseling agency. And when we, the counselors, get that document, we have to go back and retrieve or try to retrieve the initial documents that were signed at the time the home was purchased, to include the note, the warranty, the deed, and those other documents, and then determine whether or not it was a situation under the guidelines of the mortgage underwriting, whether or not the homeowner got a fair shot at the type of loan, the amount of loan, the loan-to-value ratios, and other things that may have caused the foreclosure to begin with. My concern is right now, because I see both sides, and by working these files, we get a myriad of different circumstances that warrant the independent review and some mortgage assistance. The biggest issue is that the homeowners are made aware that these agencies do exist. In most cases, we're nonprofit organizations. We're funded through various programs under the TARP, or the bank have, in some cases, their own modification programs. And unless we are notified or advised by a homeowner that you're in trouble, a default, or you see an imminent situation where you know the hours are being cut, or there's going to be a projected hardship where you can't make the mortgage, then they need to contact a housing counseling agency give that information to them and let them determine what program exists that's going to best satisfy their mortgage situation. In a lot of cases, we do get clients, especially under restoring stability, where we have a short-term fix to your mortgage crisis. Once you're bought current and those payments are made, then you still may require some type of modification because you're looking at a long-term obligation, and we just need to make sure that we give you the best service available for the best option that currently exists.
Dwight Gooden with Helping Hands Community Outreach Center. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Not a problem. Take care.
The overall national settlement between the federal government and the mortgage servicers totaled $8.5 billion. $3.3 billion will go directly to the borrowers affected, and another $5.2 billion will go for other services like loan modifications, credit report corrections, payment for lost equity, and other reimbursements. You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. This week, Senator Faber, the new Senate president, has announced positions for the Senate, and Kettering Republican Senator Peggy Lehner will continue serving as chair of the Senate Standing Committee on Education. She joins me here to talk about what's happening in the next year. Thanks for being here today.
I'm glad to be able to be with you.
Tell me, when it comes to education, what are the main priorities that you're going to be looking at as we look at the year ahead?
Well, obviously, the number one issue that everyone's going to be looking at is what the governor does, what the governor's proposal is for a new school funding program. You know, when he took office, he decided to put a temporary funding formula into place, basically holding everyone where they were at the time he took office, and promised that he would come up with a new funding formula as soon as possible. It's taken a bit longer than he anticipated. Terribly complicated, very difficult. Obviously, it's something that if it had been easy to solve, someone would have solved it well before now. So everyone's looking to that with great anticipation.
We know that legislators, their number one priority is going to be the spending blueprint, the budget that's going to be approved in June. What kinds of things are we going to see in regards to education?
Well, I think it all very much depends on the funding formula. I don't anticipate that there's going to be a lot more, if any, additional money appropriated for education. You know, we're all hoping that at the very least it doesn't get cut any further. I think if people are looking for any large infusion of money in education spending, they're going to be disappointed because there's no such infusion out there to be had. It's going to be more a question of how money is allocated than it is how much is allocated.
There's money that's available for the rainy day fund, as I understand it. Some Democrats and liberal groups are saying, well, we should be spending that money on schools and education. What would be your response to that?
Well, I think it's irresponsible for the state to not have a healthy rainy day fund. That money is there to deal with crises, emergencies that occur. It's the sort of money reserve that you need if you head into another recession. And, you know, there's certainly enough talk out there that that could happen again, depending upon what continues to transpire with the fiscal cliff. So I frankly think it's irresponsible to be spending that money. The last governor allowed that fund to be cut down to 89 cents, and it was a top priority for Governor Kasich to rebuild that into a healthy reserve, and I don't think we're going to see him wanting to disrupt that and go back to emptying out that fund.
A lot of schools in the Miami Valley have been having some trouble fiscally. We have levies that haven't passed, a lot of school budgets being cut, many saying we can't cut anymore. What kind of solutions are you going to be doing at the state level that are going to help these schools make it through these difficult times?
Well, unfortunately, there are not any easy answers to this question. And, you know, I wish I had some. Everyone, every, you know, local district took a hit in the recession. Frankly, we aren't in a whole lot of better situation right now. So unfortunately, many, many schools, Huber Heights is one of them, have made all the cuts they can possibly make, short of doing away with extracurriculars and cutting teachers, et cetera. Somehow we have to solve this problem. I think it's time that we maybe look for some new revenue sources. I think there are some opportunities for additional funding at the state through a severance tax on the fracking industry in the eastern half of the state. The governor would like to use that money to lower people's income tax. I think we maybe need to be looking at maybe if it couldn't be better spent helping local communities not have to raise their property taxes. the casinos are going to be starting to produce significant amount of revenue, much of which is appropriated to go to schools. You know, if we're going to make education a priority in the state, which I think it is for this governor, it certainly is for me, then we have got to do something to address this very serious problem of funding. Some of that is, you know, making sure we're spending our money the right way, but I'm becoming increasingly convinced that many of our schools have cut as far as they can.
I have been speaking with Senator Peggy Lehner. She's a Republican from Kettering and the chair of the Senate Standing Committee on Education. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Emily.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. But before we go, we want to encourage you to check out WISO's website for a special report on the challenges facing international students at Miami University. It's an online exclusive written by Miami University journalism students who worked with WISO's news department as part of their class. I'm Jerry Kenney. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.